This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Jacqueline Novogratz. She's the founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund and author of the memoir, The Blue Sweater. I spoke with her on January 8th, 2010, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in a private recording studio in New York City. This interview is included in our program, A Different Kind of Capitalism, Jacqueline Novogratz and the Reinvention of Aid. Download the MP3 of that produced show at speakingoffaith.org. I guess the only thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I spent the last few days immersed in your book and also listening to you speak and, you know, reading other things you've written and said and things that have been written about you. And I think that we could spend an hour just talking about your story as it's told in the book. I think that I want to spend a bit of time there, but I want to focus on the present, on what you're doing now and what you're learning now, and weave in the formative experiences you had in that way rather than spend 45 minutes telling the story of how you got here. Does that make sense?
That I actually love that idea.
Okay, all right. So I mean, I do want to spend a little bit of time telling some of that, and I can tell some of it in script too, but I just think it's important for people to know what's happening, you know, what this is now and what it means now. So, but I'll lead us.
All righty.
Okay. Chris, how are we doing for sound? Okay. All right. Well, I want to start by asking you a question that I ask everyone, whoever I'm talking to, whether it's a quantum physicist or a theologian and whether they're religious or not, but just to tell me a little bit about what you would describe as the spiritual background of your childhood.
Well, I grew up in a very Catholic family. My grandmother immigrated from Austria, as did my grandfather, as adults. So it was immigrant and Catholic. Mm. And so I think spiritually it was certainly a very religious family, but also a culturally spiritual family where not only did we have lots of nuns and priests in the mix,
right.
but a real integration of that into daily life, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to my first grade to a Catholic school and was very much influenced by a nun, Sister Mary Theophane, who probably more than anything, almost from a spiritual place, would say on a daily basis, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I mm-hmm. think that that had a huge impact on me.
You know, you wrote, I can't remember the context right now, but there's some place in your book, I think, where you're talking about a quality someone saw in you as an adult. And you talked about how they, among the qualities they saw the Catholic girl who can scrub a kitchen floor until every until every corner shines. And I mean, I marked that because you absolutely have a work ethic, right? I mean, that's also part of what you are sharing in your work with others. But I was intrigued in that connection you drew with the Catholic culture, as you say.
Well, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that every Catholic girl was raised by the exact same Catholic mother because our experiences are so similar. And certainly for my mother, and I'm sure for her with her mother, you didn't just clean a floor. The floor wasn't clean unless you were on your knees in the corner. And when I meet other women, particularly my age, I find that the same level of expectation was often put on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I definitely think that there's a whole cultural aspect to what is expected of you. And in some ways, to the notion of work as a spiritual act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've loved reading about the kind of influence John Gardner had on you. And, you know, fast forward now to your young adulthood. Mm. And now, of course, he was his credentials are manifold. He was former head of the Health, Education, Welfare under Lyndon Johnson. He had led the Carnegie Foundation, started the White House Fellows Programs, Common Cause. You met him at Stanford Business School. It seems to me that he also, as an adult, formed if not your spiritual imagination, certainly your moral imagination.
Oh, he absolutely did. By the time I met John, I had lived in Africa, lived in Rwanda, and as you said, I was a very spiritually oriented kid. In fact, I wanted to be a nun when I was a little girl, probably better, a saint, since we always had to read the saint's cards. But what John did was give me a framework for looking at the idea of community, of service, and of commitment, and how we interact within it in the world. And certainly more than any person besides family, he had the greatest and continues to have the greatest impact on me. I think I hear his voice almost every day. He would say things to me like, Jacqueline, it's so much more important for you to be interested in the world than to focus on being an interesting person. Or commitment will set you free. And in some ways, he would almost answer my completely driven questions with koans. And just look at me as if the answer was so self-evident, and and truly it often was.
Here's just an echo I saw that was so interesting. One place you were writing about him, and you said that he exhibited a tough-minded optimism. And in my conversations these past years with people of, what I call the up-and-coming, as I think about the difference between idealism, let's say in the 60s, which was the model that a lot of us knew growing up, I like to think of what's going on in the world now, or some people have said it this way, and it's also one way to talk about what you do. It's a pragmatic idealism. And yeah. I thought there was an interesting echo between tough-minded optimism and pragmatic idealism, and both of them are different than the idealism, in some sense, that came out of the 60s and formed a lot of what we think of as aid, right? The world you're working in now.
That's right. One of my favorite quotes is by Dr. Martin Luther King, where he says that love without power is anemic and sentimental, and that power without love is reckless and abusive. Right. And I think that that's really in many ways, the challenge of our generation. Do we have the moral courage to walk holding both love and power? Because I think that's the only way solutions really will be had. And do we have the courage to fight for what is right, but not in a way that's winner take all? Fight in a way that produces solutions where we're creating more justice, more opportunity.
And you, you're working now, your Acumen Fund and your work in the world has given rise to, or at least been a very formative part of, a kind of new concept of patient capitalism. And I'd like to get around to talking about that and very concretely talking about what that looks like. But first of all, I think it seems important whenever people are talking about patient capitalism to talk about what it's not, right? It's kind of a third way. It's not aid as we've known it these last 50 years. It's also not the same thing as investment or socially conscious investment. So I wonder, what I'd like to do is if you would reflect with me for just a few minutes on, how you came to that notion and, in fact, those words, which are very intriguing and some might find an oxymoron, patient capitalism. Talk about some of the turning points that brought you to this different way of coming at these issues, these problems, this human condition.
Sure. I started off my career as an international banker during the early 1980s when the world was going through another banking crisis, this one concentrated in Latin America. So I was spending a lot of time in Chile, Brazil, Peru. And I fell madly in love with Brazil and was really intrigued by the favelas where the low-income people were living and by how much work was being done in the streets. And then my day job was at the bank essentially writing off millions and millions of dollars of loans that were not going to be repaid, all of them given to the elites. And it dawned on me that the low-income people not only didn't have access to loans, but they didn't even have the ability or the courage, call it whatever you want, to walk through the doors of the banks. And so learned at an early age that the market by itself was not going to reach low-income people, was not going to solve problems of poverty. In many ways, didn't even see low-income people as potential participants or consumers.
Right. And you you also say that you did love banking, right? You loved being a banker.
I loved it. Uh-huh. I loved the intellectual challenge. I loved understanding the power of money to invest in a innovative person and her or his idea, to understand, you know, why do we need working capital to enable a company to build processes and inventory so that they can provide services and build jobs. I liked everything about banking except for the fact that it wasn't open to all. There was a kind of a deep line. I mean, we used to call it redlining, across which a whole group of society was excluded. And so, you know, at that time, I was starting to explore whether there were any options out there and learned about microfinance, this idea that Muhammad Yunus had come up with in 1976. So it was still very early, considered very fringe. But I thought it was a great idea and wanted to somehow get involved. Long story, but moved to Rwanda to help a group of women start the first microfinance bank in the country. And at that time, there were even big arguments as to whether it was ethical to charge interest and really interesting time. Through it, I saw the power of using a different kind of capitalism to reach women through providing them access to credit. But I also saw the destructive capabilities of aid. This was pre-genocide and already saw so much waste on the ground. But certainly after seeing what had happened to Rwanda through genocide and seeing how money channeled to groups of people who then controlled who got access to that, to those resources, not based on any sort of merit, but based on who they were, whether they were insiders or outsiders, really convinced me that this top-down approach to aid was also not going to solve problems of poverty and that there had to be a middle way.
And this was in the, you were there in the 1980s, is that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. I was there from 86 till about 89 and then went back after the genocide.
It's interesting. I don't know how it looks from where you sit. I mean, from where I sit, which is not, you know, inside the universe of aid and development as you are, it seems to me that there's been kind of a tipping point in terms of general public awareness of the problems with aid as it's been done and as it's been practiced and imagined for several generations. But then, you know, when you look back, there are, in fact, many accounts of people like you and also many accounts from Africans about this not working, but in fact, what is it, $500 billion have been spent in Africa since 1970. It's kind of astonishing that it took so long for this story to be told as widely as it's being told now.
Well, in some ways, I think it's connected to how interconnected we've become as a world and how much more information we have. I think it's dangerous, though, to say, you know, all aid is bad.
Right.
And part of what we need as a world, and I think it is linked to spirituality, Krista, is more nuance, more recognition that life doesn't happen in just black and white ways. And so there are incidences, certainly the eradication of smallpox, the near eradication of polio, we still have work to do, where top-down solutions actually are the only kinds that will work.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to get a vaccine to every single person in the country, you need to work with bottom-up groups, no doubt, businesses, nonprofits, anyone you can find. But there needs to be a directive that as a society, we must vaccinate every single person or we won't eradicate this disease.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. So let's talk. And I absolutely agree with you. I also think when this discussion takes place, a lot of people don't know to distinguish between relief and development. And obviously, those are different kinds of situations. And as you say, there are so many good people. I mean, also, it's easier to fault the results of some of these projects, harder to fault intentions that went into them, right? I mean, I think I remember you writing, you wrote a paper, one of your papers that you wrote was The Cost of Good Intentions as you were working in those early years.
Well, you know, that also comes from the Catholic background as well. My mother used to say, good intentions, you know, litter the path to hell.
Right.
when I would say, well, I tried really hard.
It's interesting thinking about that forming this third way you've come to for thinking about
knowledge. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, but I think I think it is so important. I mean, intentions count, and certainly in the Quran, there's a lot written about the importance of the intentionality. But we can't, this goes back to the head and the heart. We can't just say, well, they tried really hard. That's enough. Mm-hmm. We need to hold ourselves much more accountable.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So here, some of the things that you have concluded that form the way you do your work now is one observation you made is that free money backfires. So tell me why.
Well, for a number of reasons. First, as I was saying before, free money often sets communities up for power struggles between insiders and outsiders. Mm-hmm. So free money comes to somebody who then decides who gets it. Second, free money often creates dependence rather than dignity. And as you said before, in relief, there are moments where you need to get people resources and money so that they can just survive the day. But when it comes to finding more systemic approaches to giving people the chance to lift themselves out, they need to be treated as partners. When you give them the free money, it's almost inevitable that you see them as dependent on you and they see themselves as dependent on you. That's not a dignified way to interact, create partnership, nor does it provide any incentives for the individual to grow. And we've seen that over and over and over again. I was just in the slums of Nairobi, where there are book clubs now, reading The Blue Sweater, and it's just this incredible opportunity to talk to the people I write about. I'm very, very low-income people. And the disdain they have for the people who come in and like Lady Bountiful, and they give out the money. And there's a laziness in them as well, according to the people in the slums who want partnership, who want opportunities to really grow and build economics, build micro economies. And so I think those two reasons are the most important.
You have there's a line, I believe it's in The Blue Sweater. I think it's a very striking sentence. You wrote, generosity is easier than justice.
Yeah, almost enough said. I think that really understanding what it takes to create a just society, a society where people have opportunities, and then building it. In some ways, it's the great challenge of our world, and always has been. So much more difficult than giving a gift and hoping that things work out well.
So where did the term patient capital or patient capitalism come from? Do you remember?
You know, I don't really remember. And a number of people lately have been giving me an acumen all the credit for it. And I actually think that terms like that often come from almost memes, lots of different sources that organically go through. And I'm not sure if we coined it or I coined it or who coined it. But I remember when I first started Acumen Fund talking a lot about the problem of capitalism is that it gave no time for entrepreneurs really to innovate and experiment in the lowest income sectors of the economy because, one, no one with real resources saw those lowest income sectors as real markets. Hmm. So there was no real R&D put into the markets. And two, you were really looking at markets where there were terrible distribution, no roads or very muddy roads, no electricity often. Individuals that had obstacles in front of them, whether it was clean water and thinking that, you know, water comes from God, so why would I ever pay for something like this?
Right.
Lots of fatalism, no experience and no money, people making $1-$2 a day or less. And so to expect that an enterprise was going to get started and flourish in a 1 to 3 or even 5 year period was naive. But that if we could use the tools of capitalism and have the patience to invest, expect at or below market returns, and combine it with a lot of management assistance, because we see all over the world that the biggest issue is talent. We don't have the management systems, that over time you actually could create a viable entity with sustainability that would sustain itself for the long term and would grow. And so I suppose it was in those kinds of conversations where the word patience kept coming out, kept coming up. And then people would say, well, maybe it should be slow capital. And I thought, well, slow feels lethargic, and it feels too connected to the slow food movement.
Right, right.
Which has been more for the privileged.
Yeah.
You know, we need something that is really a word that exemplifies what we need to be, even though we're impatient people. And mm-hmm. so we started playing with this idea of patient capital for impatient people.
Right. You know, Jacqueline, I have to say, as I was immersed in all this, I don't think patient is one of the words I would use to describe you.
You would not be alone in that. My team teases me about that.
Okay.
It's very interesting with Novogratz that you think we have to be patient.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, so I think rather than talk about it, what might be most helpful is to illustrate this. And let's talk about, take me through the process of one of your longest running projects. I thought maybe Water Health International would be a good example, but if you want to use another example, that's fine too. Because, okay, so here's, one question that occurs to me is, how do you avoid some of the same pitfalls of knowing what low-income poor people need better than they know themselves, right? I mean, that's the criticism that I've heard and that you write about.
Right.
So what's built into your process that makes the people who are being served also your partners? Does the initiative come from them in the first place?
The initiative typically comes from an entrepreneur.
In
this case in India.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in this case, it was even more complex. It was a Ghanaian entrepreneur who found himself in Los Angeles with a technology built by an Indian scientist at Berkeley who had tested
globalization.
This is where the whole global, right?
Right.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
And they had tested a UV filtration system for purifying water in the Philippines and really wanted to see whether this could work in India. And so it was not the local community, but the context around this was I was finding myself increasingly being asked to speak at conferences on panels where the question was, is water a human right and should be given free to everyone, or is it a scarce commodity that
right.
we need to price? And I thought, this is just the wrong question.
Right.
The point is we have 200 million people in India alone with no access to clean drinking water, 400 million people with limited access. So let's experiment. Let's try. When we found Tralance Addy,
did you find him or did he find you? How did that connection get made?
Probably a mix mm-hmm. because so much of this is networks and, again, global networks. Mm-hmm. There were people at Berkeley who told us about Trallance, another friend of mine who works in development had told Trallance about me.
Okay.
And we ended up having early conversations, you know, a couple of years before we then went back to them when they were ready to, because we had said, we'll never do a startup. And you learn constantly as an entrepreneur never to use the word never. and so because we had a proven technology and a proven business model, by that point, Trallance had learned through the Philippines experience that he wasn't selling a cool technology. The poor didn't care. Whether it was UV filtration or reverse osmosis, they wanted to know that they were getting a service of safe drinking water. Because he had already gone up that far on the learning curve, we decided to take the risk with him. We invested $600,000 in equity. We bought shares in this new for-profit company of patient, knowing that it was going to be a while because everything we were going against every odd. As I said before, people thought water came from God. Why should they ever pay for it? They had never paid for it before.
Right.
The villages were very far away. People made $1-2 maybe a day. You know, very little cash in the overall community. And we were introducing a new technology. Government people felt that it was going against government policy, which was that free water for everyone, despite the fact that so few people were actually getting it. Hmm. And many of the elites with whom we spoke said that it was unethical for us to be making money off the backs of poor people. And so fighting all of those barriers decided, but nobody's even trying. Nobody's experimenting.
Right.
And so we put the $600,000 in and then started working as partners. The first thing that came up, and again, it's a differentiation between a charity and a for-profit, was the recognition that the original plant in the village, which was a huge blue diamond, and was mostly made from materials that were not from the village. They were not locally sourced. We brought in an Acumen fellow for about 4 months, a guy named Ankur Shah, who was a McKinsey consultant with an architecture background. And he worked with the company and did a redesign of the plant to make it modularized so that we could then move these across many, many villages in time.
Hmm.
In a typical nonprofit, it would have been easy for me to come and take you there and show you this beautiful blue diamond, and you would say, oh, my goodness, it's so wonderful. But we wouldn't really be talking about whether it was scalable, whether we could really grow it in a cost-effective way. The second thing we did was realize that the banks had no tradition or history of lending for the delivery of water in rural areas. And so no banks would lend to the local entrepreneurs who were going to be buying these plants. And so we put up a first loss guarantee with a major commercial bank in India. Again, using patient capital, we could take the risks that traditional investors and capitalists would not take.
So again, the money is going to entrepreneurs there on the ground who are going to be implementing and managing this.
Exactly.
But you're helping make that loan possible.
We make the loan possible to the banks so that they can lend to local entrepreneurs.
Okay.
We invest in the local company. And then we have a locally based office that provides management assistance to the company.
Mm-hmm.
Long story, not that short. Today, or a couple weeks ago, I was at the opening of the 285th plant. So now there are over 400,000 customers buying water on a regular basis in a sustainable way. And government has noticed, obviously. And so the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is the state in which it's operating, a state of 65 million people, has just contracted with the water company, WHI, to build 300 more plants. And so in the next couple of years, we're going to see over 1 million customers of this water company. For me, what's been so amazing is that now with one investment in one company, over now 5.5 years, we're seeing an industry rise that is specifically focused on bringing water to low-income rural villagers for the first time in India.
And so what makes this model different from a grant model, for example. I mean, grants might have funded even that kind of expansion, right? But then it would have been, they would have been, for sustainability, they would have been dependent on further cycles of grants, right? But in this case, right, are they, have they become or will they become utterly financially sustainable, profitable?
They will become. They're still in such a high growth mode, mm-hmm, that they're not. They're not profitable. The $600,000 we invested at the beginning, and IFC was a partner with about the same amount, has enabled the company to raise another $40 million in more traditional capital.
Okay.
So the first differentiation from grants is access to significant capital. It's very, very hard for a small nonprofit working at the community level in a four-year period to raise $40 million and expand to 285 villages.
Right.
And there's just not that much capital available in those specific ways. Once you move into the capital markets, whether it's the quasi-capital markets where you would stay in the realm of patient capital or moving further toward traditional capital like the International Finance Corporation and individual investors, there's really unlimited potential to make that match. The second differentiation is much more focus on monthly accountability. Much easier to understand what's happening at the local level because of the financial statements that are connected to what's happening.
This gets at an interesting observation you've made, that markets can act as listening devices. I mean, I think you mean that on many levels, not just this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was once giving a speech in Pakistan, and a feisty human rights activist stood up and he said, you know, you call our people poor. You know, how dare you? And I bet that you've never even spoken to a poor person. And I said, you know, first of all, when 80% of the population lives under $2 a day, that you're allowed to call a part of a population poor, and we need to do something about it. And I said, but, you know, I'm not going to sit here and argue with you around whether I have spoken to poor people. What I've learned over the last 25 years of working in slums and working with low-income people is that if I give you a gift, even if I gave you, Krista, a Christmas gift, you would be highly unlikely to tell me what was wrong with it.
Right.
And in fact, when I visited, you might even put it out on the mantelpiece to make me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
That same thing happens with traditional charity. If I ask you to buy something from me, you suddenly become a customer with a big attitude as to what's right about it and what's wrong about it. And suddenly that conversation that we're having becomes much more real. And so in that way, the market is a listening device. The market has huge limitations, and we have to recognize and deal with that. But it also is one of the best listening devices we have on the planet.
You know, I had a conversation about a year and a half ago with Binyavanga Wainaina. Have you come across him? He's a Kenyan writer.
I know Binyavanga very well and like him very
much. Oh, it's fantastic. And so one of the things that he's written, and as much for other Africans as for other Kenyans and people in other countries in Africa as for outsiders, is, you know, one of the things he points out is that when you are constantly being, well, that when you're called poor by people coming in who want to help you, even people who want to help you, he says that he grew up feeling like he was being defined by what he didn't have, right? He was being defined in terms of his deficits and what was wrong with him.
It is so true. It, you know, despite this, I was giving a conference. I mean, I was speaking at this very fancy conference. It is so true. And in fact, one of the Acumen Fellows, Josephat from Uganda, grew up in a really, really poor village in on the border of Uganda and Rwanda. Actually, probably not far from where Binyavanga's mom's from.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all my life, it was as if my middle name were poor.
Right.
They just kept calling me poor. And what's been so extraordinary for me with these book groups of people in the slums of Kenya reading The Blue Sweater is that people will write me emails from, you know, internet cafes, and they'll say, Jacqueline, you know, thank you for showing us what a person can do, and you've overcome so many challenges that it gives me courage to think that I also can overcome challenges, both in my own life as well as helping bridge the gap between rich and poor. And I think, oh my goodness, you know, this guy lives in a shack.
Right.
And by every definition would be called poor except his own. He doesn't see himself
right,
as poor.
Right.
And he sees me as having just a different set of challenges than he has.
Yeah. What did you say to people who, and I think this is a question a lot of people in this country would instinctively ask, people who said to you, you can't charge poor people for water. That in itself is unjust, outrageous.
You know, I actually think there's a long-term conversation with the world that we probably shouldn't charge people for the first few liters that are essential to living healthy lives so that we can ensure that every single person has access to it. But that it is one of the most increasingly scarce commodities. We're seeing water wars occur all over the world, but certainly in India. And that as a society, we actually do need to think of it as a scarce and precious resource and think about what it will take for people to be more thoughtful about the way that it is consumed. And so that's a long-term conversation about how does the market work with government to create a model where everyone has access and we are being much more conscious about the utilization of a scarce resource. In the short term, my response is when 400 million people have no access, and we know that the poor are willing to pay for things of quality that they value, and with clean water, they see a connection over time, obviously, to their children's health, which actually saves them money. That let's start with something that low-income people can begin to control themselves because they're sitting around waiting for somebody to give them this.
Right.
History has shown us that it's just not going to happen.
And I guess I heard you saying a minute ago, I mean, it may sound ironic, but that when you turn someone into a customer, you empower them in a way to be more demanding, to be more discerning.
Absolutely. We have we actually have a 50-50 joint ownership between Acumen Fund and the government of India to run a private maternal health care chain of hospitals. And they call the women who are having babies customers, which may sound crass. And yet, there is such a differentiation when you go to the public hospital, where ostensibly the women are getting services for free, but typically they pay between $10 and $20, 500 and 1,000 rupees in bribes when they're having their children, 500 for girls and 1,000 for boys. That at LifeSpring, by calling the women customers, the women become involved in suggesting changes. They want private rooms. They want little benches where their mother-in-laws can sit. None of that exists at the public sector hospital. The cost at LifeSpring is about twice as much as what they would pay for the 1,000 rupee bribe, 2,000, which is about $25 for a normal delivery. And the whole feeling of the place is so different. And what's so complex when you're looking at low-income markets is that sometimes the poorest families will make decisions to go to very, very expensive hospitals for lots of reasons, particularly if they think they're having a boy child.
Hmm.
And wealthier families will sometimes send their daughter-in-laws to the public hospital for free. And so I think the most important thing that we're talking about here is choice. And I think that giving all people choice to different opportunities is so connected to their individual dignity. And that's what we're really trying to do. Not saying this is always better than that.
Right.
But we clearly don't have the solutions when over a billion people have no access to clean water or electricity or adequate health care. We need to experiment, and we need to experiment with all the tools that we have at our disposal.
So one of the points that someone like Binyavanga Wainaina will make, and that is made in a bit more pointed way by an economist like Dambisa Moyo, is that these the countries you're working in, places like India, countries like Kenya, these are young nations, right? I mean, old cultures, right? Long histories, but young democracies. And so Dambisa Moyo, who's made quite a, who's gotten quite a lot of attention in the West for her ideas, you know, says that that these countries must evolve to places like the West, where the government picks up these basic services and has accountability to its own people for these kinds of services. Do you worry that you're preempting that? I know you've had conversations with her also.
Yeah, and she's also a good friend. Krista, I don't worry. And the reason is that I believe that, you know, today in the 21st century, a lot, if not most, of our public innovation will start with private innovation. And we're starting to see that with Acumen. Just as with water health, began purely as a private sector play and is now in a major partnership with a government in India,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing the same, where LifeSpring is now also in conversations with government as to, you know, this idea, can you now take this model? Because it costs a woman 2,000 rupees for a delivery in LifeSpring. It costs government 5,000 rupees to pay for the natural birth for a woman. So it makes sense for government to say, we actually have a model that's one-fifth the cost, mm-hmm. because it costs 1,000 they charge to. Why aren't we outsourcing a lot of this to a company rather than trying to do it all ourselves? We have another private-public partnership in Nairobi, where Binyavanga's from, for toilets. When I lived there in the 80s, the public toilets, ostensibly run by government, were dangerous, dirty places that nobody would ever go.
Right.
And Ecotact now has 30,000 people a day going to these toilets, paying 5 shillings to use the toilets. They see them as government toilets. And ultimately, and they are public-private partnerships, ultimately they may be fully run by government. We don't know. But this goes back to this draconian, all aid is bad, all subsidy is bad. Mm-hmm. We can't start there if we're actually going to build the kinds of models that will grow to reach millions of people and sustain themselves over time. And we've seen what government by itself can and cannot do. And so while I absolutely agree with both Dambisa and Binyavanga on the end point, I really believe that using private innovation through patient capital, because again, these innovations can take, you know, 5, 7, 10 years mm-hmm. to get right. They can lead to extraordinary public sector change. And with this interconnected world, from my perspective, once we've shown that you can deliver water safely and affordably to low-income people, or maternal health care, or sanitation, or drip irrigation, if government doesn't want to scale that, and they continue to, allow things to fester with corruption and inefficiency, then I think you start calling on networks of young people to hold a government accountable, but not in a way that says, do something better, but says, look, it can be done better. It is being done better. Now let's partner to take it to the next level.
Have you had experiences of young people playing that kind of role?
Not yet. Well, that's not true, actually. In one case, which is quite an extraordinary case, we're invested in an ambulance company called 1298 Ambulances, run by a great guy named Shafi Mathur in Bombay. Now, Bombay, city of 17 million people, had about 70 working ambulances. The emergency service delivery, highly corrupt, highly inefficient. So these guys said, we're going to start a private company. We're going to deliver emergency services to all people. So if you are taken to a hospital, you pay. If you're taken to a public clinic, you pay half the price or whatever you can afford, free if you can't. And in a real emergency like the terrorist attacks last year, obviously it's all free. And
but they ran it as a business.
But they run it as a for-profit company.
Okay.
And we own about 30% of it. When the terrorist attacks did occur, the government noticed that these guys were the first responders and really true heroes. And now they have, again, a public-private partnership in four states in India. But at the around the same time, Shafi decided he really needed to take on the fact that the ambulance services were so corrupt.
And is Shafi the entrepreneur?
He's the entrepreneur. And he got together about 20 young people, young lawyers, who took on the case with him and essentially took the case all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the long and short of it is there's now about $1 billion of tenders that had not been gone through a legal bidding process that are back on the table, which is really industry changing to start rooting out corruption. It was really done through movement and understanding of young people.
Let me ask you a question that that's always there for me, especially these last few years, as I've started looking more at this and had some conversations with people like Binyavanga Wainaina and now with you. You know, I was intrigued reading your personal story that when you finished at Stanford Business School, I think you wanted to go back abroad, but John Gardner encouraged you first to look at microfinance in this country. Is that right? I mean, you quote him saying, "What happens overseas is profoundly influenced by what happens here, especially now, and the reverse is true as well." And I don't know when he said that to you, but I think that becomes more true every day. Here's the bald question, right? If we can't solve poverty, if we can't ensure health care for every pregnant woman in New Orleans, you know, or the Bronx, or parts of Washington, D.C., who do we think we are going to solve these things for people in other countries?
Well,
and how can we think that we have that knowledge? You know what I'm saying?
The most important thing, Krista, is that I don't think that we go over to help them solve, to solve their problems. Mm-hmm. I think that, the whole idea of Acumen Fund is that we don't go over as with banners saying, we're here to help. We go over and say, we're here to invest. We're here to invest in local entrepreneurs with the best ideas that are bringing basic services to low-income people. And quite frankly, my dream is that we will find innovations that are serving poor people in the developing world that will come back to the United States. And I think we're already starting to see where we could learn so much from some of the innovations that we've invested in India, Pakistan, Kenya, Tanzania. And so from my perspective, it's not, oh, look at America, we're great, let's go over. I actually see myself as part of a single world that is becoming more divided, not nation to nation, but rich to poor. And so I say it in the book, but I really believe that the elites are becoming more like each other across national borders than they are to low-income people in their own countries. Mm-hmm. And I definitely feel, I'll meet someone in Karachi, Pakistan, but we went to the same schools, we eat at the same restaurants, right. And a very different experience than a conversation with someone from Appalachia or a migrant worker in Southern California. So I don't see it as we're here to solve your problems. I see it as where can we find innovation in the world that is doing the best job at reaching the most people possible at the lowest cost while not stripping the product of its beauty and all of the things that human beings want. And then can we take those innovations and can we take those business models and can we start exporting them to other countries, to other communities, so that we start building blueprints for what it ultimately takes to extend the economy to every person on the planet. So my orientation is absolutely not the North comes to the South. And in fact, each of our country offices is staffed largely by locals and then surrounded by local advisors so that we're building hopefully and ultimately self-sustaining acumen funds in the countries where we work.
Mm-hmm.
We have no expatriate salaries. We've tried to be very conscious about creating a global organization, not an American organization that does development work.
I actually watched some of the presentations you made at your annual meeting with your investors. I think it was the 2009, which was really, it was really interesting. It was really helpful for me. And I was very intrigued with some of the language you use. You know, you talk about sharpened financial edges with spiritual underpinnings. And I'm not sure that's an exact quote, but that's the gist of it. I mean,
it's close enough.
Yeah. Is that language compelling for your investors? Is it uncomfortable for any of them? Are you creating a different kind of ethos? How do you think about that?
You know, it's uncomfortable for some of them. And I think that as patient capital starts to take hold, and I believe it ultimately will become a new asset class, there will be lots of conversation about, you know, what kind of financial returns versus social impact. Mm-hmm. Are there trade-offs? I find these to be some of the most intellectually challenging and inspiring conversations imaginable. But for some people, they're so gray that I've had investors say, Jacqueline, just get the returns and that will bring the magic and the spirituality you're seeking.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
And I just don't believe it. I believe we want to be inspired. I believe we want to be more connected as a world. I believe we all have that feeling inside that if we don't start grounding our actions in a basis of spirituality, whether you want to define it from a religious context or from this idea that we're all connected to each other, we really won't solve the problems that are so big in front of us. And at the same time, we have that opportunity to do so. And so we are trying to hold that balance of at Acumen Fund, of a hard head and a soft heart, of really demanding excellence of ourselves and of the entrepreneurs in whom we invest. And at the same time, working from a place where in many ways, we bring divinity into the work that we, you know, we listen. We try to put ourselves in the shoes of the other so that we understand that if we're the investors with the money, there is a power dynamic that's underway and that we might have to listen differently and use different language with the entrepreneur with whom we're working, depending on whether they're from a slum in Nairobi or they're a very sophisticated entrepreneur from Los Angeles that wants to work in India. Different kinds of conversations, and we need to develop the moral imagination and the more nuanced emotional skill set
mm-hmm.
that cannot compromise the financial skill set but must absolutely complement it.
So I know you have incredible testimonials of the effects of your work on people who are poor, on entrepreneurs who might not have had possibility, on people who've been fellows in your program. I wonder what you hear about how this work changes investors.
Oh, it's great. That's a great question. Over the holidays, I actually got a number of letters from investors who shared lots of different stories with me. And One that was really touching to me is was from a man who went to El Salvador with me. Acumen doesn't work in El Salvador, but we were just going to look at some of the potential work down there. And we had to drive through the hills on this on a pouring down rain day in the back of a pickup truck with a group of farmers, and it was freezing. And these farmers were hard-bitten, you know, hard-scrabble, scruffy guys. And we sat in a circle together, and my friend, the Acumen investor, who is an unbelievable investor in his own right for major financial gain, was hammering these farmers with questions. And I dare say showing off a little bit. And at one point, one of the farmers corrected his math and said, excuse me, sir, but actually you've got that wrong. Let me explain. And in the letter that he wrote to me, he said, you know, the biggest gift that Acumen has given to me, and this sounds, and this might, it's almost embarrassing to say, he said, but the biggest gift that Acumen has given to me is that you've shown me how smart the poorest people in the world are, and they're just as smart as I am, if we could only give them the opportunity to make change themselves. Hmm. And so I think it's that growth and awareness that it's so much more comfortable in some ways to look at really low-income people as the other, in part because I think we know that they are us, and certainly in my case, I'm only two generations away from it. The women I see in Africa are very much like my grandmother was. And so maybe there's a fear there that encourages us to stay comfortable, not go close.
Right.
And Acumen says, you know, come, go close and see the explosion of human potential if we treat people as equals.
And I just want to be really clarify this. So your investors, I mean, are they getting any financial return on their investment?
Up until now, none. The answer is no. Mm-hmm. They give us money and we say back to them that you will, the money that we invest will come back to Acumen Fund. Any returns that are made to the fund go back and are invested in to other enterprises serving the poor.
Right.
We're typically seeing, you know, four times for every dollar that we invest, we see the companies raise an additional four. We give them metrics. We talk about successes and failures. And so the pitch, if you will, to donors is that that this is highly leveraged, more accountable money that will continue to recycle itself in time. And they get change back. They
right.
don't get financial returns.
Right. The return is in social change rather than financial.
That's right.
Okay. Okay. Where do you find sustenance? Like, how does your moral sensibility continue to evolve as you have these experiences? I mean, you've really started an innovative, successful enterprise. This is all, it's very, you know, the trajectory of your work has been dynamic. What do you keep learning that takes you deeper, that sustains you? There must be also hard times. You see a lot of suffering as well, right? You see a lot of places where it's hard to imagine that human potential being realized.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny, Krista. First, I think what feeds and drives me is I never feel successful. I always feel that, okay, well, we've gotten to here, but the questions just keep getting deeper and deeper. And Rilke talks about the importance of asking.
That's something we have in common, that we love Rilke.
We both love Rilke. Yeah. But, you know, that asking deeper questions. And part of the sustenance comes from, I really think I'm on one of the most intellectually exciting journeys of our generation. And the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know anything. And so that's one whole piece of just the pure intellectual inspiration. The other are the kind of emails that come both from the wealthiest people in the world and the lowest income people in the world. The joy that I get from those interactions gives me a feeling of being connected, not just to rich and not just to poor, but across the spectrum. And I would say when you talk about seeing suffering, that is not what burns me out. And in fact, I think I, for some reason, have the personality that when I'm in a place, I tend to see the positives, the possibles. What exhausts me is the lack of caring from too many elites, that where we see solutions that actually are not that hard to undertake. And whether it's government bureaucracy or selfishness, we become unwilling to even experiment with it. I find those conversations are the ones that drain. Sitting in a slum, even with terrible conditions, even after lots of violence, can hurt at the deepest emotional level. But it also reminds you of just how alive we are.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't drain me. It makes me angry or, you know, every other kind of emotion, but not draining.
You know, I want to ask you about that, and I don't even know how to formulate this question because it's tricky. About that exhilaration there is, I know this in my own life in very different contexts, but of going to an utterly new universe, right? You know, you wrote about being in Brazil. And I think many of us have experienced this in different places. But you said, you know, I couldn't recall ever feeling so fully alive, getting ready for a day, except in those first weeks in Brazil. There was a rawness and a beauty here that brought every emotion right to the surface. I loved the feeling, loved being in this place where the best and worst of everything seemed to coexist. You know, in my younger life, I spent time in Eastern Europe where there was a very different kind of human crisis going on, right? But that I would say that same thing where you saw the best and worst of what human beings were possible of. And it is, it can be full of despair and exhilaration at the same time. So what's my question?
I wonder if what you're getting at is, you know, why do we feel that way? Mm. And I think that there's something about being much closer in a more raw way to the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about in our daily lives, in the States often, you know, we hide death. We hide a lot of infirmity. We don't even really see where our food is grown or how the animals are killed before we might eat them. So there's a veneer in many ways over a lot of what makes us very deeply human.
Right.
When you're living in a place undergoing change and turmoil like that, the veneer is just stripped and you are right there with, I think, living in a way that is just deeply, deeply human.
Right, the best and worst of the human condition all out on the surface.
All out on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so then here's a more troubling question. Do we want other people in the world to be developed the way we're developed, right? I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Are we giving them the tools to become like us?
Well, to not give tools feels paternalistic and a different form of judgment, that we're just giving them the choice because it's too easy. And I've brought people into low-income rural areas and slums, and they'll say, well, look how happy everyone is.
And I said, well, right.
You weren't here the day that her third child died before she was 1 year old.
Right.
You know, you weren't here when her husband and all of her brothers died of AIDS. You weren't here walking beside her every single day for 5 hours to get her water. That to give people choice is, I also think, fundamental to the human journey and the human spirit. And we don't know where it will all go. My dream would be that we could actually slow down and learn from what people have, the joy of community, the time for each other. I have to say, I sound somewhat hypocritical as someone who could not be busier.
Yeah, well, okay, but yeah, you know, some of the stories you tell in The Blue Sweater are about dancing everywhere you go, right? Dancing and singing.
I love dancing and singing.
Yeah, well, and those are things that we've lost in the West. We've lost storytelling. We're trying to recover it. We're kind of recovering it online, right? So, I mean, maybe what you're saying is that maybe patient capitalism can mean that we... That societies don't have to lose all that we have lost a lot in the West in our affluence, right?
We have, and there's also opportunity to regain. You know, with the Fellows Program, we spend 3 days reading Aristotle and Plato and Martin Luther King and Ibn Khaldun and Gandhi and. It's all about storytelling and listening and because people come from so many different cultures as well, about food and dancing. And that is part of Acumen's culture, too, at our holiday party. There's always a karaoke machine. That there's there is a way to bring into our workplaces more of the community building, more of an emphasis on storytelling. Because storytelling is so connected to leadership anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, again, I think that is being rediscovered in the West. But I did want to ask you about the Fellows Program, and I actually think that's a pretty good place to be ending up on. Because another, it seems to me, it's a core tenet of what you do, not just supporting these entrepreneurs and projects, but also seeding the world with talent, as you say, which I guess have you found that as rare a commodity as capital in some places, or at least not or skills to trained talent or supported talent?
Yeah. The Fellows Program started in part because we were so inundated with applications from the business schools from all over the world, yeah, as well as design schools, engineering schools, and we had no place to put this this energy. And on the other side, as we were saying before, there were real management needs in the companies that we serve and invest in. And the third reason was I really wanted to see an alternative career path that was very legitimate for people who were highly skilled in business and finance and had their other skill sets beyond consulting and investment banking. And so we started this Fellows Program just for 10 people a year, and we only open the application process for about 3 weeks a year. And we typically get about 600 applications from 65 countries. So there's a real hunger from people from around the world, and we bring them together for 6 weeks in New York City, and they come from all over. This year's class has a guy named Zahur, who is from a small village that's between Peshawar and Swat in a really, really isolated tribal area of Pakistan. And just, you talk about moral imagination. Josephat from Uganda, a woman from Zimbabwe, Lebanon, the United States, Ghana. When they're in New York, we expose them to leaders, to thinking about financing companies and how do you even begin to structure the financing of companies in a country and a sector that has no other competition, so there's nothing even to benchmark. We send them out into New York for a day with $5 and a Metro card, and their job is to come back at the end of the day with an analysis for us of how they would redesign services for low-income people from the perspective of the poor themselves. And they come back with these incredible stories. Some of these young leaders have never been to the United States before. And, you know, a woman from Kenya sat in a a shelter with women for about 3 hours. And she came back and she said, you know, it was so confusing because their families live in New York, but they prefer to live in the shelter. And that's where they feel they are most welcome. And as a Kenyan, I can't even understand that.
Right.
And so that sets the tone. As I said before, we have 3 days where I talk about values with them through the readings. And then we send them off for 9 months. They work in different companies. They work in whether it's maternal health care company or D-Light, which does solar electricity for rural villages in India or housing in Pakistan. And they work at the upper management levels. And at the end of their tenure, we move them. We help them find jobs somewhere in the social enterprise sector because, as you said, we're looking to seed the sector, not keep them all for ourselves, although I'm very tempted every year to do so.
You said something at the annual meeting, which I watched. You said of the fellows, you were sending them off, and you said their job as leaders is to leave a company that is better for them but not dependent on them. And that's a very, very challenging order, isn't it?
It is, but I think that's the job of all of us as leaders.
Yeah.
And it's the very
But it's not a classic Western view of leadership.
No, probably not classic, but although I do think there are extraordinary leaders who, you know, live in that way. You know, next week I'm going to Nairobi, and I'm going to be visiting Jamii Bora, which is a nonprofit community development organization that started by a woman named Ingrid Monroe with about 50 truly, you know, the poorest slum dwellers 10, 12 years ago. And today they have 250,000 of these low-income slum dwellers who comprise the membership. And about 5, 6 years ago, Jamii Bora decided that it wanted to create a for-profit housing development company largely for themselves, build 2,000 houses outside of Nairobi. And we put $250,000 into it as a loan. And Ingrid is one who, you know, who wants to leave a legacy that will continue without her. And I went back recently to see one of the women who was buying a house named Jane, and I tell this story on one of my TED Talks. Ex-prostitute, HIV positive, you know, really had nothing. And Jamii Bora won't give you a loan until you save up your $50 first. Hmm. And so she saved her $50, she got her $50, and it took her 5 years, but she then bought this $4,000 house. And when I asked her, you know, tell me about your dreams, tell me where you are today. And she said, you know, when I was little, I wanted to be a doctor and I wanted to marry a good man. And, you know, I married a bad one. Mm. But my children love me. And I'm not a doctor, but I work with HIV patients. I volunteer and I serve them and I tell them, if you're, you know, you're not dead, you're still alive, and so it's your duty to serve. And so she said, you know, so maybe I'm not a doctor, but in some ways I'm better because me, I heal people. I think about going back to see Jane next week because she hadn't moved into the house when I last visited her. And she's now running a very profitable kiosk in this community of 2,000 houses, so probably about 12,000 people. And I think it's that kind of trajectory, it's that kind of story that if we move away from just the traditional charity, I'm going to give you a handout and hope that, you know, life gets a little better for you today, and invests in Jane, that we cannot just help her make herself a little bit wealthier, but actually walk with her as she moves out of poverty, because what happens immediately is that she starts bringing a community with her, not only her children, but in this case, the people that she volunteers with who are HIV positive, so that the world then really becomes a world where each of us help each other release all of the energy that we have to give. And so that's, I think, the ultimate ethos of a kind of leadership based on moral imagination, but that's not willing to compromise, and essentially lower expectations, because I definitely have learned that people live up or down to the expectations that are placed on them, but keep them really high.
And I know that, I mean, Acumen Fund is it's a young enterprise. I know that some of the that there has been wariness or criticism, that of course you can tell beautiful stories like that, but you can't affect the larger picture of poverty or maternal health or clean water, that these are huge global issues. Now, I know that that's something that's very much on your mind, about scaling this work. And I think what you said does suggest that changing the life of one person does mean more than changing the life of one person, right, in any context. But how do you think about, or what are you learning as you move through this I don't even like the word solutions. I bet you don't either.
No.
But about how can this model that you're innovating, that other people are innovating with you, address these human crises in a large holistic way? Maybe even, as we were talking about earlier, ricocheting back and helping people in New Orleans rebuild their lives.
Yeah, I think, I think about this all the time.
Mm-hmm. I know you do.
Oh, my goodness. Because that's the end game. And I think, you know, what do I have, 30, 40 years left? You know, I don't have a lot of time if we're going to be, you know, seeing this large-scale systemic change. And so for us at Acumen Fund, we have about $40 million that we've invested. So as you said, compared to the world problems, it's a drop in a bucket. Although it's brought in about another $180 million into these enterprises. And already we've seen tens of millions of people get access to services and 22,000 jobs. So the numbers, as you said, pretty picture. Not making enough systemic change yet. But what's starting to happen, and I think Water Health International is one example, is that by proving and demonstrating that you can deliver affordable, safe water to low-income people at scale, not 10,000 people for 5 years, but, you know, 1 million people, suddenly sectors start building around that idea and that company. And we now see 5 companies that are in the water space in this one state, reaching 1,000 villages. Government now looking at this as a model for whether this can or cannot work through government. And so we're starting to see patient capital invested in private sector entrepreneurs, both for-profit and nonprofit, building companies or organizations that are reaching hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, opening up a larger conversation about what is truly possible at a systemic level. And so this next phase for Acumen Fund has to be more, or at least integrated more, with a voice around what kind of policies might be shaped to allow for this kind of enterprise to reach more people. What are the systemic changes that are possible? And that's really my dream, Krista, is that Acumen itself needs to grow to continue to prove and show these models. But that doesn't have to solve every single problem by itself.
Right.
Acumen can create models, but then we have to be even better storytellers at showing how these actually are effective, how they can cover their costs, and how they can reach growing numbers of people so that others can replicate it, use the lessons from it, and ultimately change the whole nature of the game.
And has patient capitalism entered the lexicon of business schools?
Oh, yes. In a very big way. We at Acumen speak at most of the major business schools. And I would say that there's a groundswell of young people in the business schools that want to craft lives of deeper meaning, and they're looking for how they use their skills to work in social enterprise, work in environmental sustainability, and patient capital is very much a part of the conversation. And we're starting to see it. I was at a planning meeting for Davos, and the term patient capital was used throughout the meeting, which was really thrilling to me.
Yeah. We just have a couple more minutes. This may be a self-indulgent question, but you quoted Oliver Wendell Holmes about the simplicity on the other side of complexity. I've heard that phrase, but I didn't know where it came from. You also have written, and you were writing about one of the places you were, about the beauty and possibility that you could always see on the other side of chaos. I wonder how that way of looking at life, how that is alive for you now, how that runs through the work you do and the way you think about the future.
Oh, my goodness. I think that the leadership that we need for the future is a leadership that's willing to hold opposites in our hands, and that that in some ways, Krista recognizes, I think, that we are going through a tumultuous time right now on our way to a more empathetic society, a more integrated society, clearly a more interconnected society. I'm a real optimist. And, you know, speaking of faith, that is ultimately what it's about. I think the world is getting better. There are less wars today than there were in the last century. There are less people being killed. There's still ugly things happening, and in many of the places that I work. And I've seen a lot of ugly in my life, obviously. Mm-hmm. But right next to it, just right there, is some of the most extraordinary beauty and possibility imaginable. And so I think you hold on to that vision and we keep walking forward, which isn't to say that we're not going to fall down
right
along the way. But it's the vision of what is possible. And that vision, which goes back to your question on sustenance, is continually inspired by the people themselves who are creating extraordinary lives out of what we would consider nothing.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's a great last word. This has been a great conversation. I knew it would be. I really loved it. And
thank you so much. I did too.
Thanks for making the time. And we'll be letting you know when this is going to be on the air. And I did want to ask you. I think you said in the meeting that you that the syllabus for the fellows program, all the readings that you do, the curriculum that
yes.
That people are using that in book groups. Do you think we might be able to link to that on our website as well?
Oh, we'd love that.
Our listeners and readers and podcasters love to read and to be able to. I just think that would be fascinating. So we might send you an email about that if that's okay.
Oh, that would be great. And in the back of the paperback,
yeah.
We've also listed the syllabus.
Oh, okay. I have a hard cover. So the paperback's coming out when? Next month?
In February.
Okay.
February 10th, I think.
All right.
And so that's where it is. But we would love for you, because it's linked to our community site, and
yeah.
And book groups are starting. And I'm actually going to do kind of an Uber book group meeting in Kibera, the Nairobi slum.
Okay.
In a wow. Week and a half.
Oh.
Which will be really, really fun.
Yeah.
To see in action.
Oh, great. Maybe you can write us a little report about it.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that.
Okay.
And Krista, I'd also love to, if you're ever in New York, just have a cup of coffee with you. I truly, when I read your book, I thought, well, there's a sister here.
I know.
Just really.
Yeah. I will call you. I'd like to do that too.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And I'm going to be in New York a few times coming up in the spring. I've got a new book coming out as well. And
oh, great.
Yeah.
What's it going to be called?
It's called Einstein's God. And it's centered around my conversations with scientists. And it's fun. So
that is great. I read your article about the woman neuroscience scientist who I really loved, who's a Jew.
Adele Diamond.
Adele Diamond.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I loved
great.
That.
Yeah.
She sounded just fantastic.
Yeah, she was. Oh, good. All right. Well, our paths will cross again. We'll let you know what's happening with this. And wait, I have a question from behind the glass. Oh, you say Jacqueline, right? Say your name.
Yes.
Say your name. Jacqueline Novogratz.
Jacqueline Novogratz.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard her say it. Okay.
All right.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks a million.
Yeah.
Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.